originally aired in November 2006. Astronomer and scientist Carl Sagan was a pioneer in the field of astrobiology, the study of the origin, evolution, and future of life in the universe. He was also an advocate for a scientific worldview, one with no space for religion or creationism. Today, we sit in on a discussion between Sagan's widow, Anne Druin, his former colleague, Steve Soter, and Hayden Planetarium director, Neil deGrasse Tyson. They talk about Sagan's science and the search for God.
If we can bring the house lights up, and we'll go to Q&A, and I'll wait for me to come around with the microphone. Thanks.
Yes, thank you both for your ideas. In this discussion of religion and science, it seems that religion's chief function, one could arguably say, is to deal with the subject that science empirically cannot, and which you have not mentioned in your presentation, but have alluded to. And that word is evil. What does science say about evil, or what is the role of science in addressing evil, which is a pernicious human problem? The problem in the species that converts everything science makes against the species.
Well, that's a very good point. And I would say, I wouldn't go as far as you have gone to say that it converts everything that science makes into against the species, but way too much. But for me, that is, you know, when you say evil, religion's view of evil is as a supernatural phenomena. Science doesn't see it as a supernatural phenomena, but as a fact that it's part of our evolutionary baggage, that we can understand it much better when we look at the history of our evolution and how we got to be this way, and demystify it. I mean, I think that religion actually has a very hard time with the problem of evil. Because if you posit an all-powerful God who calls all the shots, and then you create a situation like, for instance, the extirpation of the Native Americans on this continent, or Auschwitz, or any one of a number of very long, tragically long list of crimes, it's hard to understand how, and I think that there's a very wide-scale acknowledgement among the religious community that it has no answer for this question of evil, because we're talking about the untold suffering of the innocents and something within that all-powerful God's control. Scientific understanding of evil is to demystify it, to understand its components. And that engine of demystification is, in my opinion, our best shot at combating evil. Rather than creating a kind of symbolic representation of evil and giving that representation a power over us when it may not even exist. So, science has been horribly misused. I completely agree with that. And I feel that it's incumbent upon scientists and the general public to work against its misuse. But I don't believe that the real solution to these questions comes from outside the realm of our understanding of who we are and how we got to be this way.
In principle, it could come from the studies of neurobiology that they're now doing in the brain centers and what controls emotions and passions and socially deviant behavior. We have another question here.
The question that has stuck in my mind as I've heard many conversations about the conflicts that exist today is just the conversation we had tonight. Why? Why isn't it a bigger part of the public conversation? It just seems to be hidden and it's not coming out. What is it going to take to make it a bigger part of the public conversation?
Annie, you're CEO of a media company, so it's all your fault, right?
I'm doing my part. I'm doing what I can. No, you're right. It's not much talked about on television. I think it's part of that sense that, you know, everyone else in the country believes something other than what maybe you or I believe. I think 9/11 was a kind of such a trauma for our country that, as we saw, it was a kind of a great leap backwards into fear-based politics and fear-based religion. And suddenly, it felt like we were living in the 1950s in certain ways, in that there was suddenly a consensus that I didn't even know it existed of a kind of a public piety in a very traditional way, and a kind of doffing of the hat at every turn to this kind of public agreed upon idea of what our view of God is. And I think that the fear, the seismic fear, is retreating. I think with the events of the last week was a great sign that that's happening, and that those old appeals to to a very kind of confined and very rigid idea of what spirituality is and what patriotism is and all those other ideas is finally receding. And maybe we'll see more of these conversations. I mean, the fact that these books are on the bestseller list is another sign in the wind that maybe the zeitgeist is shifting back to a more questioning point of view.
Annie, I'm reminded of just a couple of days after 9/11, President Bush gave a speech. I forgot where it was, in the Rose Garden or at the Capitol, but in an attempt to distinguish we from they, he made the following statement, loosely quoting from Genesis. He said, "Our God is the God who named the stars." Now, of course, as the astronomers in the audience know, 2/3 of all stars that have names have Arabic names. So this was probably not his intent. But the alignment, the religious alignment, started very early, immediately after September 11th. That's exactly right. We have another question here.
Thank you.
It's really a comment. I wanted to speak to your reference to Dr. Sagan as a popularizer of science. I'm part of a generation that was inspired to go into the physical and chemical and biological sciences after the publication of Intelligent Life in the Universe with Josef Slowski in 1960. And just some examples of Dr. Sagan's popularization. He once was asked on a radio program, "What are the implications of life elsewhere in the universe?" To which he responded, "What are the implications if there isn't any?" Also, he once said that the function of cells is so amazing, we eat mashed potatoes but don't become mashed potatoes.
I mean, it's not true that you are what you eat, you know.
Thank you for those recollections. I had never heard the mashed potato one. It's wonderful.
It seems like a lot of the discourse right now is related to the lexicon of what is, you know, religion, what isn't, what is spirituality, what isn't. And I was wondering if you think there's a risk in using a word like spirituality, which by definition refers to a spirit or supernatural force, in applying that to the world of science, if there's also not a risk of, you know, putting people on a defensive who would be religious, do believe very intensely in their spirituality and how that relates to a God and a supernatural being, if there's not a risk of, you know, kind of shutting down intelligent debate and just putting them on defensive.
I'm trying to understand, by using the word spirituality, because we're a little bit hobbled by our language. Our scientific society comes so much later than our language. Our language is rooted in a pre-scientific age, and so it's, you know, I've thought, and we've all tried to find another word that captures that. And you're right, the derivation of the word is specifically...
Well, but please. Spirit is the same as the word inspired.
Yes,
it
right.
has to do with breathing.
Right.
With
right. Right. And so you...
In your breathing, you're interacting with the atmosphere, this life-giving ocean that we live in.
Doesn't it come from a kind of a classical notion that you're breathing in the spirit of a god, or
yeah,
god
yeah.
breathes
any etymologists here on the word spirit?
But it doesn't necessarily require that it be supernatural.
Actually, I think what matters is not who invented the word spirit, but how it's getting used at any given time. And so how it's getting used, when a religious person says spirit, they mean something usually different from what a scientist means when a scientist says they had a spiritual moment. Because, right, when I'm on the mountaintop and I get misty-eyed, I feel spiritual, but I'm not feeling like there are woodland spirits.
Right, but the word inspirational is neutral, is it not?
That is. That carries no baggage.
And yet, the inspirational comes, as Steve just pointed out, from that same spiritual, that same use of the word spiritual or spirituality.
So are you going to keep using the word spiritual?
I'm going to keep using it. I don't know.
Thank you.
You touched before on the nature of evil. Can you extend the discussion to ethics? Because, like it or not, religion has claimed ethics as its turf. And one of the problems when you have a discussion with a religious person is they say, well, if you take away religion, then you take away ethics, and science has no structure or system of ethics to replace the one that we have now, and society will therefore fall apart.
Well, for a million years, we were hunter-gatherers. Probably a million years before we developed any of the religions that any of us would recognize as being religions. We were hunter-gatherers, and from the few remnants of hunter-gatherer society left, which may not be representative of the vast majority of them, but give us some insight into what our ethical system was when we were hunter-gatherers and we lived in small bands, 70 or 50 people. And I think part of what's why we are in such a time of upheaval and dislocation is not only a scientific revolution, but just merely the fact that now we live in aggregates of 10 million as opposed to, I think the invention of agriculture and our settling down has really, we haven't yet come to grips with that. We're still dealing with the after effects of that great change in the way of being human.
But, by the way, that would include communicable diseases, which were mostly unheard of before we all settled down together and lived sandwich style in apartments.
With domesticated animals.
I've seen no evidence from what I know of the majority of surviving hunter-gatherer people that they were not only our equals ethically, but in some ways, and this may be an idealization, but in some ways, that they had a better sense of what it is to share with a community, a better sense of what it is to be part of the social fabric than we do. And I don't see any evidence in, if you look at the history of the last several thousand years, there's no evidence that you can point to, if you have anything, I'd like to hear it, in which the fact that there were religious ideologies kept people from treating each other with unspeakable brutality. In fact, the great challenges to our ethics as a civilization, slavery, the Holocaust, there were religious individuals who were exemplary, but the great religious institutions were not. In fact, in some cases, they aided and abetted mass slaughter. So I'd love to see, I'd love to hear a great argument for the ways in which religion has actually made us better than we naturally are.
I'd like to add, Ed and I were attendees at a workshop at the Salk Institute just a week ago where this subject came up multiple times. Salk Institute is one of the centers of neuroscience, and there's a lot of studies on brain function and brain behavior and human behavior as a product of brain behavior. And one of the repeating issues that came up was about this ethics issue or morality, more broadly. And some interesting sort of rebuttals to that point were raised. For example, if you look around the world at nations that are sort of the least religious, you can rank them. And up there are like the Scandinavian nations. Denmark has the highest percent of any nation in the world of people who are just outright atheists. And if you look at these countries, there's not a higher trend for those countries to be less moral than countries where there's a higher percent of people claiming religiosity. That would be the first indication that you need a religion around to surround you in order to ensure that you behave morally. And that it's not borne out in the statistics of nations. But not only that, there are passages in the Old Testament, for example, in Leviticus, where there are sort of recipes for how you should treat people who misbehave. Among them is that you should stone adulterers. One of them, I think, is you create great harm to a child who disrespects an adult. And we don't do those things because deep inside us we know that that's wrong to do that. Yet it's written that way in Scripture. And so we're applying some other understanding of morality beyond what the instructions are in a religious text in modern times. And so what that tells us is that whatever is the source, which that can be argued and debated, we are continually evolving our sense of ethics based on the emergent society in which we live, which tells us that slavery is wrong, which everybody justified biblically at the time it was being conducted. And we're doing that by some other, and who knows what that is? That's an interesting question. Where do we get our morals that are in place when they're not actually derived from Scripture? And so it's a major frontier in philosophy. But I just want to share that with you, and that was a common recurring theme. A question right here.
Man has been seeking God since they've been walking upright. I was wondering, why is it that we could continue to keep on seeking God, and we continue to keep on explaining him, and we continue to try to explain fate in some godly kind of way? And I was wondering, can we all think of faith as an individual issue, or rather than just seeking this explanation through something higher than us?
I think that's an excellent point.
Great. Yeah. Well, we're primates, and we come from our ancestors. We're used to looking for the alpha male to tell them what to do, to comfort them, to protect them from predators, to protect them from dangers. And this is a kind of a vestige of that. I mean, the fact that we think of God as him is curious, especially...
And you know it's a she, of course. That's right.
Well, either way, yeah. You know, it's just the idea that God has a gender is a very funny notion. The creator of the universe is either male or female. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, we are, you know, one species of a huge number of species. Our tenure on this planet is 5 minutes compared to the planet itself and the other life forms, many of them. So it's just funny that, I mean, obviously it's a projection of us, just like our visions of the extraterrestrials have a certain reptilian character to them.
But one of her points is that it persists. It's persisted for thousands of years. In spite of the scientific revolution, in spite of the industrial revolution, in spite of the information revolution that we're now experiencing. So there's something that it seems like it's not going to go away. And so do we, rather than fight that fact, should we find some way to embrace it or understand it on another kind of level rather than simply present what would be a substitute for that emotion?
I think I go with the latter. Yeah, I mean, I think understanding is the key to everything. It's always better to understand. But I don't pretend to know. My opinion is that I agree with the latter, but I certainly don't pretend to know the answer to this very big question.
I personally feel that religion has two main goals. And correct me if I'm wrong, but to explain the unknown and to provide a system of ethics for society. So I was wondering, over time, do you feel that religion has gone so far off path that it's lost that main idea that it has in the first place?
Yeah, I think that's a great statement, a very good description. I would say human social organization is another task of religion, organized religion anyway. But, yeah, I think its ability to explain the unknown pales in comparison to science. And so maybe that's what's happening, is that having lost its ability to explain the unknown, having made up stories about that explain the unknown that are in many ways no longer tenable, religion evolves into something else. And maybe part of what that is science.
And I would let me modify his question and then get your reaction again. If I sort of make an adjustment to that question and say that religion may have historically provided answers to the unknown, but today religion historically provided answers to the unknown. Today science works really good at that. Perhaps an enlightened religious scholar would say, no, religion supplies answers to the unknowable. Or a way of, that's another better way to say it, a way of embracing the unknowable.
But if you really want to embrace the unknowable, why don't you call it what it is and don't pretend you know it? Why don't you say...
Okay.
Why don't you say...
All right, a good one.
And if you do that, then you're fine.
And then everybody's cool with that. Okay, another question. We're going to take two more questions.
Hi. I wonder, from my experience with intelligent design, it doesn't seem very different from 18th century deism. And I wonder if you could give me an explanation for why it does seem to recur so often and become popular, and whether or not there is some kind of final argument that can defeat it.
I think it has to do with our need as a species to feel special. And intelligent design catches on because it's a way of resting back from science, cloaked in scientific language and with cloaked in scientific authority. Wow, there was a reason why we came to be. And there is a God who made us. And since we like to think we're in control on this world, that we can rest that kind of, that feeling of being at the center of things that science has taken away from us. And since science has been so successful at doing that, to cloak our need to feel special and central and designed by a loving designer is finally satisfied in scientific terms.
By the way, Anne, one of my favorite examples of why we are not in charge is the knowledge that there are more bacteria in your intestines than there are people on Earth. So we are just sort of housing for bacteria to live out their lives.
That's the bacterial point of view.
The bacteria.
Thank you guys both for speaking tonight. This might be unanswerable, but it seems tangential to a lot of what we've been talking about. So here in this room, we're having a very reasonable, calm discussion, but kind of outside this room, you know, there's a bit of a war of ideas going on. There's Bill O'Reilly's culture wars. There's all kinds of things, and it seems like science takes it offensively when intelligent design wants to be taught in schools, and rightfully so, in my personal opinion. And there's a lot of back and forth, and people seem to take it really offensively and get very heated, and there's not a lot of intelligent discourse. And I'm wondering if either of you, or you, sir, as well, have any thoughts on how to resolve that better. Are there ways and methods? Are there new things that can be published, new conversations that should be had to kind of end this war of ideas and make it more of a discussion?
Allow me to clarify one point, and we'll go straight to Steve. I've been pretty outspoken personally on intelligent design and what the consequences would be if it took hold in our educational system. The consequences, speaking even just practically, to the future economy of the nation, because it would undermine the creativity of someone who might otherwise find a solution to the problem, but says, no, this is too hard, God did it, and let me go on to another problem. And that just stops progress. But my point there is, I personally never had a problem with teaching religion or intelligent design in schools. The problem is when either of those are put forth as science in the science classroom. And that in that way, the science student does not understand or is confused as to how science works, and then you undermine the future scientific literacy of the nation. But there's no denying the value of comparative religion, for example. It's taught in every college, right? So I don't think anyone here would say you should not teach this somewhere in the curriculum. It just doesn't belong in the science curriculum. But Steve, you had
you made the point exactly that I was going to make, that it should be taught in history of religion, in philosophy, and other places, but not as science, because it is wrong.
You know, that's the simple answer. just wrong.
It makes falsifiable statements. It says that all the structures of biology are intelligently designed, but we just mentioned that the wings of the penguin, the wings of the ostrich, our wisdom teeth, our vermiform appendix, which only has the function of suddenly killing us without any warning. These are not intelligently designed. These are vestiges.
Oh, so there could be a designer, but the designer is equally as stupid as intelligent,
well, the designer is very interested in beetles, because the designer created 500,000 different kinds of beetles.
Hi, this has been an exhilarating discussion, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
It pulls up a lot of things, but in answer or in a speculation about the idea of constantly pursuing sort of an external, ineffable God to explain what we can't, do you think the fear of death overpowers our enthusiasm for life, that we need some solace in the after, and we have to believe in that?
I think if we were honest with our children and didn't lie about death to our children, they wouldn't grow up needing to believe that we don't die. And we would solve a lot of these problems. We showed enough confidence in our children to tell them the truth about the preciousness and the finiteness of life. I think that we would see a society that was less attached to the notion of the afterlife.
Thank you. I just want to know, where do you see America, the world, 5 years from now? I want to ask that of both of you. And what are you doing about that fact?
Can I answer the first part?
Okay, sure, go.
In Carl's words, prophecy is a lost art.
Prophecy is a... So you're not going to be an oracle for us today, no?
Yeah, also, besides, I'm always wrong. So I can tell you what I think, but I can assure you that it would not come to pass. Right. But so I have no idea where we'll be, but I have a lot of hope based on the events, recent events, that we are coming to our senses. And that's all I know.
Do you have questions or comments about our show? We would love your feedback. You can send us an email at scienceandthecity@nyas.org, or you can leave us a voicemail at 212-298-8654. If you want to know more about science and culture in New York City, you should check us out online. Visit scienceandthecity.org. We'll see you next week.